Now the text that we use in our own meetings, our own pujas, is extracted from a work known as the Bodhicharya Avatara, the entry into the life of enlightenment, a work written by the great 7th century Indian teacher Shantideva. Shantideva was remarkable in many ways. He was a great thinker, a great metaphysician. In him the intellectual side was well developed, but he was also a very great devotee with great faith and devotion, as well as being a remarkable and outstanding poet. A little later on this evening we shall ourselves be celebrating here the sevenfold puja, reciting these verses extracted from the Bodhicharya Avatara of Shantideva. And I would say, in fact I would emphasize, there is only actual participation in the sevenfold puja that can give us any real understanding or appreciation of its significance and its effect. In other words, of the way in which participation in the puja does succeed to some extent in refining our emotional energies. But before we come to the sevenfold puja this evening, a brief commentary on the seven parts may be of some assistance to those of you who have not participated in the sevenfold puja before. Now, the seven parts of the sevenfold puja are, first of all, worship; secondly, obeisance; thirdly, going for refuge; fourthly, confession of faults; fifthly, rejoicing in merits; sixthly, entreaty and supplication; seventhly, transference of merits and self-surrender. Now let me just say a few words on each of them in turn. First of all, worship. This is addressed in Buddhism principally to the Buddha himself, to the Buddha not just as a human historical figure, but to the Buddha as the ideal of enlightenment, as the symbol, if you like, of enlightenment. And worship of the Buddha as the ideal of enlightenment represents our recognition of the worthiness, represents our recognition of the value, the supreme value of this ideal, as well as of the desirability of its realization by us. This is what worship essentially means. And it finds outward, if you like, ritual expression in the making of various symbolical offerings. And especially we offer, in the course of the worship, flowers representing the impermanence of all created things, lights representing the illumination of wisdom which we aspire to attain and realize, and then lighted incense sticks symbolizing the fragrance of the pure life, of the holy life, which we aspire to live, wafting in all directions and influencing all with whom it comes into contact. And these three offerings, the flowers, the lights, and the incense, are offered in front of the Buddha image on the altar with this understanding and with this significance, representing our, as it were, consecration of ourselves to the ideal of enlightenment, at least of our recognition of its worth and its value and its desirability. Secondly, obeisance. In other words, bowing down. This represents the paying of outward physical respect. Buddhism says, as it were, it isn't enough to keep it in the mind. Express it outwardly. In fact, if you have any strong inner feeling, you will want, inevitably, to express it outwardly. Because you have a body as well as a mind, as well as a heart, and if you feel, if you experience something totally, you experience it physically also. So So obeisance, the bowing down, is the outward physical expression of the respect which we feel for the ideal of enlightenment. It represents also, we may say, a sort of realistic recognition of the distance which as yet separates us from the ideal. When we worship, or we recognize, well, there stands the ideal of enlightenment. But when we make the obeisance, when we bow down, then we, as it were, recognize, well, here stand I. I'm looking up towards that, but I'm still a very great distance from it. Then thirdly, the going for refuge. Going for refuge, that is to say, to the Buddha, the enlightened one, to the Dharma, the way to enlightenment, and the Sangha, the community of those treading the way to enlightenment. We began in the worship by recognizing the ideal. Then with the obeisance we realize the distance at which we as yet stand from the ideal, and now in the going for refuge we commit ourselves to the actual realization of the ideal. We commit ourselves to treading the way leading to its realization, and we are aware of the fact that we're treading that way not alone, but in company with many other people who also can help us along that way. So this is what it means to go for refuge, to commit ourselves to the Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment, the Dharma, the way leading to that ideal or the realization of that ideal, and to the Sangha, to the company of those with whom we tread that way leading to enlightenment, and from whom we derive encouragement and support. Fourthly, confession of faults. This is simply recognition of the darker side of ourselves, of what Jung calls the shadow. There's no question of breast beating or bewailing our sins or anything like that. It's a question of a realistic appraisal of our own shortcomings and weaknesses so that they may be overcome. And it comprises also a resolution that we will overcome that darker side of ourselves. We will conquer it. We will get beyond our shortcomings and our weaknesses. So this is confession of faults. And fifthly, rejoicing in merits, or if you like, virtues. Here, we recollect the noble lives of others. We think of the Buddhas, all the enlightened ones, the great bodhisattvas, the great spiritual teachers. We think of beings like Milarepa, beings like Wai Lang, beings like Han Shan or Hakuin. We think of the great spiritual teachers and leaders and helpers of humanity of the past. We think even of ordinary people that we know who upon occasions act in a self-sacrificing or noble or generous or kindly way, and we derive enthusiasm and inspiration from the example of all these people. We think as if, well, they are also human. What they have done I can also do, because I am a human being. I too can attain to that level. I can be no less noble and no less worthy than they are. So this is what we call rejoicing in merits, feeling happy on account of other people's spiritual attainments and deriving strength and inspiration from the contemplation and recollection of those attainments. Then sixthly, entreaty and supplication. This is the earnest request that those who are more enlightened than ourselves may teach us. And it expresses our own readiness to be taught. Very often we find people, even religious people, aren't so ready to be taught as they might be. So we have to make ourselves ready and open in this way. Because unless we adopt a receptive attitude, we just can't receive. It doesn't mean being negatively receptive in the sense of weak and submissive and just swallowing anything that you're told. But it means being on the spiritual level genuinely receptive to anything coming from higher sources, whether in the form of direct spiritual influence or spiritual teaching. In this connection, there's a little story about a Zen master which some of you may not have heard. The story goes that a professor at a university went to call on a Zen master to ask him to teach him. So the Zen master received the professor very politely, and as the custom is, he offered him tea. So he placed two cups on the little table and he started pouring tea from the teapot into one of the cups. So he went on pouring and pouring, and the cup became almost full. And he went on pouring, the cup became quite full. But he went on pouring, pouring, pouring. And the professor was watching all the time, and the tea flowed into the saucer. But the Zen master kept on pouring, pouring. The saucer was filled, it overflowed, it flowed all across the tablecloth in a little rivulet right onto the floor. And then the professor couldn't contain himself any longer. He thought, well, these Zen masters are supposed to be pretty queer, but this is the queerest, the most eccentric one I've ever met. He said, why are you still pouring? The cup is full. So the Zen master said, why you come here? Your cup is full. And he said, unless you empty your cup, you can't receive. No use expecting me to pour into a full cup. So in other words, we have to make ourselves empty to receive. We have to adopt a receptive attitude before we can receive. There's no question of a literal emptying. We don't have to forget what we already know. That's impossible. But we must put it aside. We mustn't let it get in the way. So this is what this section of the puja represents, the entreaty and supplication. We express our readiness, our willingness to receive the teaching. Seventhly and lastly, the transference of merit and self-surrender. Here, the dominant theme, the basic feeling is nothing for oneself. One has done all this. One has celebrated the sevenfold puja. Maybe one has meditated. Maybe one has studied the scriptures. Maybe one has advanced in understanding it. Then one thinks, no, not just for myself alone. I'm not concerned just with my liberation or my enlightenment, because basically, ultimately, there is no me, no my, because there is no I. So therefore we think at this stage of the puja, that whatever benefits I might have gained, whatever merits I might have gained by celebrating this puja, or by any other religious, any other spiritual practice or understanding, attainment or realization, may they be shared by all, not just for me, but for everybody's sake. So this last concluding section of the puja paves the way, as it were, for the bodhisattva ideal about which I spoke in the course of the last seminar. The ideal of gaining enlightenment, of devoting oneself to the life of enlightenment, not just for the sake of one's own individual salvation, but for the sake and the benefit, the happiness and the well-being of all sentient beings.